Hi, I'm Leanne Ward.
And I'm Susie Burrell.
And welcome to The Nutrition Couch, a weekly podcast from two of Australia's leading dietitians, bringing you everything that is new in the world of nutrition, diets, and good food. From The Nutrition Couch today, our trending media article is all about the different stages of weight loss. Our nutrition case study today is taking a closer look at weight loss plateaus and how we shift them. Our product review is the new Vetter Smart Protein Self-Raising Flour. And our listener question today is all about gut health. What are some easy ways you can work on your gut health? But first, Susie, how's this week been for you?
It's been pretty busy. We're doing some really great work with our podcast, and I'm actually planning a few hikes around Sydney because I, like many people, struggle at this time of year to get really motivated with activity. And before I had my twins, who are five-year-old twin boys, so very time-consuming, I used to go and do a lot of hikes and long walks around Sydney. I would go, you know, for a whole day and get sort of 20, 30 kilometres. I really felt good in my body when I did that. And I have not been able to do it. And then a friend of mine recently said that he's got some clear time in his schedule. And so I'm now starting to get back into that, which is really that time where we talk about me time and putting energy back in. I really feel like my true self when I do those really big walks. So I'm really sussing out places in Sydney. And of course, you're planning a little trip to Sydney, which is very exciting in the next few weeks. And so I'd love also to take you guys for a bit of a long walk around the city. So I've been doing some research. And for people out there who are also struggling in the winter, it's a great time to get out in the day when the sun's out, get your vitamin D hit, and just have a really good walk as a way to enjoy the outdoors, but also get some great steps and exercise in. So I'll keep you posted on any of the good locations I find.
Yeah, absolutely. And I couldn't agree more with the vitamin D because particularly here in Australia, no matter where in the world that you're listening, we have a vitamin D deficiency problem in the winter months. Like we live in a country full of sunshine, yet there are so many people that are deficient during the winter months. So as Susie said, I really encourage everyone to get out, enjoy the sunshine, get some movement in. And what I like to do with my friends is we call it a moving catch up. So rather than going and having coffee and cake at a cafe, we'll get takeaway coffees and we'll get moving. So we'll go on a little hike, whether it's around the city, whether it's out at the bay, the water, whether it's a hike, you know, maybe an hour away from Brisbane or something like that. It's a wonderful way to catch up, exercise, and also get your vitamin D in.
It is because 50% of Australian adults will have low vitamin D during the winter months, and it makes you feel terrible. It makes you feel really tired, really lethargic. Your mood is lower and you don't recover as well. Your immune system's not functioning. So at this time, particularly when so many of us are aware of immune function because of the effects of COVID, we cannot stress enough how getting that sunlight is so important, and even keeping on top of your vitamin D and making sure you know what it is heading into winter. So that's another added bonus of ticking the box on both movement and getting that much needed sunlight.
Absolutely. And I actually read an article the other day, Susie, on pediatrics, like children, the rise in rickets and vitamin D deficiency in children. And that's just not something we've heard of in the last, 5, 10, 20 years even. I can't remember the last time I heard of rickets on the rise in children. So your kids need vitamin D. They need sunshine as well. Obviously, we're not advocating to put them in the, you know, direct midday sunlight for 3 hours every day, but they need that. I mean, I'm not sure what it is for children, but I think it's adults in the winter months. It's sort of 15, 20 minutes of sort of sunlight outside of the peak period. So I think it's up to 10 a.m. and after sort of 2 or 3 p.m. in the afternoon. The Cancer Council has some good guidelines on their website if anyone's interested in how much vitamin D or sunshine you should be getting in. And for darker skin people, they need a little bit extra as well, extra time in the sun.
100%, 100%. All right. So this week, what had popped up in my media feed was a really interesting article that came from Healthline, which publishes some great evidence-based research around the phases of weight loss. And it was the first time that I had seen something published that described weight loss broken down into sections. Because I think whenever we're talking about weight loss and even writing about it, we talk about it as if it's the same process the whole way around and you're either losing weight or you're not. But I thought what's really interesting is that absolutely when people are losing reasonably large amounts of weight over time, it does go in different progressions where you may perhaps lose higher amounts, larger amounts of weights initially. And indeed, that's often the expectation of people when they embark on a weight loss program. And then it tends to slow down, and then we need to change it around to get things moving again. So I thought it warranted a good discussion for our listeners around weight loss. What is the process of it? What is the difference between healthy eating and then eating for fat loss specifically, even rather than just weight loss? So we're all a little bit clearer about what those changes on the scales mean and how you can be sure that you are on the right track, even if perhaps the scales are not translating into what you may expect week in, week out when you're losing weight over a longer period of time.
Absolutely. And the article that Susie, you're talking about from Healthline, officially sort of recommended two stages. Stage one was a rapid weight loss stage, which is an early, more rapid stage of weight loss, I guess. And the second stage was a slower, longer period of weight loss. And I think that's really important because a lot of people will lose, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 kilos in the first week or two and have that expectation that that weight loss is going to be the same every single week. So hit, you know, maybe week 4 or week 5 of your weight loss journey and it's like, oh, I only lost 500 grams this week, but I lost 3 kilos in the first week, and you get really disappointed and down on yourself. So I think it's really important to note that most people always lose the most in the first week or two. But for what a lot of people don't understand is the difference between scale weight loss and true fat loss. Because for a lot of people, what they're losing is scale weight. The number on the scale is going down, but it's not necessarily fat. That number on the scale is made up of water weight, essentially, muscle mass, which is not ideal, and also fat mass. So what we want to do when we're losing fat mass is purely just focus on fat mass. But what a lot of people are doing, cutting out carbs, cutting their calories far too low, what they're dropping is muscle stores because their protein's not high enough, and also a lot of water weight. So take, for example, Susie, the low-carb diet or a ketogenic diet. When you eat lower carbohydrate, you get rid of a lot of carbs out of your diet. You're essentially peeing out a lot of the glycogen stores out of your body, because for every gram of carbs you eat, your body stores up to 3 grams of water. So a lot of that water weight loss that happens in the first few weeks with a low carb or keto diet, I've known some clients that have lost 8 or 9 kilos in the first week or two, Susie. A lot of that is just water weight and some muscle loss because they're on extremely low calories and they just got cut out all of their carb stores, which were just, you know, peeing out a lot of water. So there is that big difference between fat loss and scale weight loss as well. And what I'd encourage people to think about is making sure that weight loss is sustainable long term, because the more you lose initially, the quicker that is to come back on again, put it that way.
So I think the other important thing to know is that we store, all of us will store between 24 and 48 hours of fuel in our liver, which is the glycogen that is stored primarily to make sure our brain always have enough energy, and then in our muscle mass as well. So for larger people, they have larger stores simply because they have larger amounts of muscle mass. And if you have been eating or overeating, and in particular carbohydrates, you are going to have chock to the max stores. And that's why people who are larger, or in the old days when we used to watch The Biggest Loser on TV, the really large people would lose really huge amounts of weight, like that 8 or 9 kilos initially, basically because they had more of that glycogen store, they had more muscle mass. And so when they suddenly cut their calories and specifically their carbohydrates way down, all of a sudden the body gets rid of, as you said, all of that fluid weight and those glycogen stores. Now, what I'm looking for is for that to be sustained over time. So indeed, we know that when people lose weight initially on a weight loss program, it's highly predictive of adherence and success. So absolutely, as dietitians, we want to go in, reduce the carbohydrate down to a reasonable level, knowing that our clients should lose at least 1, maybe more kilos, and they're going to see that change on the scales and be really motivated. But then our job, and your job, over time is to make sure that that is sustained over time, and you're getting at least 0.5 kilo a week, maybe up to 1. At best, for a larger person, I may get 2 kilos a week, but you're going to get that those high amounts for that initial 2, 4, maybe 6 week period, and then absolutely it will even out. So when I'm starting a client off, I will run them on my initial program as long as it's working. But as soon as it plateaus out, which can be as quickly as 2, 4 weeks, that is when I know I need to change things around to get that sustained continual fat loss that you're describing. Otherwise, we're basically just doing starvation where the muscles are being broken down and we're not actively burning fat mass.
Absolutely. And we're actually losing muscle mass, which is not ideal. It might make you feel good because you see the scale number going down. But over time, that's going to really damage you quite metabolically because you're just not going to be able to sustain that weight loss over time if you're pulling from your muscle stores, because metabolically, you're just nowhere near as superior as if you were just dropping fat mass. So, and then that brings us to sort of the second stage of the article, Susie, where it talks about weight loss in the second stage is a lot slower and it primarily comes from body fat, generally after about 6 weeks and beyond. And I think the biggest problem for most people is that what they're doing, they can't even maintain for 6 weeks, Susie. So that initial rapid weight loss is great and it's really motivating. Then they hit about that 6 to 8 week mark and everything slows right down and they fall off the wagon and they're like, I'm not seeing results. It's not working. So I may as well go back to my old habits. All of that weight comes back on again and they're off the diet. And that's, I think, the biggest problem for so many people is that they can't appreciate or understand when that slows down. It's not necessarily a bad thing because you're no longer losing a huge amount of those glycogen stores and that muscle mass. You're actually just focusing on fat mass, which for a lot of people might only be 200 to 500 grams a week, but it's still going down and it's still just pulling from your fat stores, which is ideally what we want. So I actually think slower and steadier, the better long term and for you metabolically as well.
As long as it is changing, and I think that lends itself to a discussion about the difference between change in body size versus change on the scale. So when I'm seeing people over long periods of time, say they want to lose 10, 20 kilos, which will take at least 3, maybe 6 months, I always do a measurement on their key body parts, so their waist, their hip, their bum, because often my observation, and this isn't scientifically validated, but my observation is if I'm getting change in the body measurements, particularly the waist around the hip, if that's where someone's carrying their weight, even though there may not be a change in the scale that week, I'm happy because to me that tells me that the body is mobilizing some of that fat mass, which may have been there for many years. And so it takes time for the body to churn it up. Remember, the body doesn't like to lose weight. The body likes to be stable. So to move fat mass that's been there for long periods of time, our body doesn't like to do that. It's clinging on for dear life. So what it's doing when the size is changing is mobilizing some of those long-term fat stores. And that's sometimes why you'll see change in measurements before you'll see change in the scales. And that's why it's really important we have a number of measurement outcome when it comes to long-term weight loss, but also not to be discouraged if it's not always the same amount. Sometimes you'll get half a kilo, 200 grams, and then all of a sudden you get a kilo, and that's the body then readjusting over time. So it's absolutely the pattern and the flow of weight loss, but it's also important to remember weighing yourself every day can be highly detrimental to that process psychologically, because if you've gone and had a meal off your plan and it's higher in carbohydrate, there's alcohol there, instantly your body will cling on to those carbohydrates, restore the glycogen and cling on to fluid. And that's what's happened when you've had a big weekend, when you've been on a tight plan, you go and have a big weekend, a big meal out, and the scale jumps up 2 kilos and you freak out and you think it's not working. That's merely the body readjusting to having those extra calories around for a brief period, and it will revert a day or two later as equilibrium is established. So I try and get my clients to weigh at most twice a week, on a Tuesday and a Friday morning, so after the weekend, before the weekend, to get the gradual pattern and flow of weight loss rather than being obsessed with that one figure on the scale, which can be really, really, you know, put you off completely when it's not or bounces back up after a heavier meal.
Absolutely. And I sort of, with my clients, wear once a week, I think maximum. And most of my clients are weighing, you know, only once a fortnight or once every 4 weeks, just because a lot of the ladies that I work with have such a huge emotional attachment to the scale that we're really just trying to get them to work on the perfectionism and the consistency, which, you know, the weight loss will come as long as they're consistent. But again, so many people overemphasize the value that the scale has. And when they don't see that number doing what they want it to do, they give up or they quit or they think it's not working. What's the point? So I really am a fan of encouraging my clients to not even bother with the scale. I know they're going in the right direction because I'm writing their nutrition plans. I just need them to be as consistent as possible. So the scale isn't something that works for everybody, but I'm a big believer like you are, Susie, that we shouldn't be doing daily weights unless you're someone who's a boxer and you need to make weight for a sport or something like that. I think daily weights are more detrimental than they are helpful for a weight loss journey.
And I think that we know if it's working or not. I'll say to clients, you know, do you think it's working? Are you noticing change in your clothes? Are you waking up feeling depleted and your tummy's flat? They absolutely know when it's working and when it's not. And I'll be honest with you, I never weigh myself. I couldn't tell you the last time I weighed myself, but I know exactly from my clothes, how they're fitting, how I'm waking up in the morning. So sure, making sure a program is working to a certain extent, but absolutely I never encourage aggressive weighing unless it's helping the process. If it's derailing it, distracting it, we just make sure we're seeing change in many other ways, not just the scales.
And clothing's one of those perfect things as well, particularly, you know, as we come into winter, some people haven't worn their jeans for, you know, a good 6 months. Pulling on those jeans and you're like, oh, these are a little bit snug and it's only the start of winter. That's pretty encouraging for a lot of people to think, oh, okay, I really need to get my movement and get my nutrition back on track. Yeah, because if those clothes aren't fitting as well, it's a good indication.
And you just reminded me, I often get clients to do the swimming costume challenge through winter. Because we rug up and hibernate and we forget what it's like to be bearing skin. If you think that you're gaining weight, just pop your cozy on and hop in the mirror, and that'll tell you very, very quickly if you're on track with your diet and exercise over the winter, and be very motivating to get you back on track if you've slipped off. So that's the swimming costume challenge as we move through the winter months.
No scales needed. All right, Susie, well, that kind of leads us nicely into our clinic question for the week. So something that I'm really hearing in my clinic this week, Susie, is about weight loss plateaus. And that, I guess, kind of goes hand in hand with our weight loss journey. So we sort of want to talk about what is a plateau and how do we overcome it. So I guess from my own personal experience, I would say that a true weight loss plateau for most of my clients, you don't really see at least until sort of 3 to 4 weeks time. A lot of people will jump on the scale, it'll stay the same for a week and they're like, oh man, I'm at a plateau. Fat loss just doesn't happen that quickly. For most people, fat loss can take 2 to 4 weeks to reflect on the scale. If you're doing something like skin fold calipers, yes, you might see those changes in your skin folds in as little as a week. But for most of us, we're just using the scale and it really does take us that 2 to 4 weeks to see that true fat loss. So I think for most people, a true plateau is 3 to 4 weeks at least being consistent with your behaviors. I think for a lot of people, they're not consistent. Their weight's going up or it's just staying the same. And I wouldn't call that a true plateau because their behaviors and their habits haven't actually been consistent. Therefore, they're actually not going to lose weight. So a plateau, first and foremost, you have to be consistent with your plan. If you're not being consistent, if you know you've been, I hate this word, Susie, but quote unquote, cheating your plan, or you've been off plan, or you've had a few big weekends, there's been a lot more alcohol, you haven't meal prepped, you've been eating out a lot more, that's not a true plateau because you're over and above your plan. So I wouldn't actually call that a true plateau. So it's actually very rare for me to meet clients who have hit a true plateau because what they're doing is super restrictive eating. So yes, they're losing weight, but then they can't keep that up. So they're kind of cheating on whatever they're doing and they're kind of putting the kilos back on again. That's not really a true plateau because they're actually not able to be consistent. So I sort of have the feeling around a true plateau being at least 3 to 4 weeks at maintenance or not moving from there whilst being consistent. How do you feel about weight loss plateaus?
100%. I would say between 4 and 6 weeks of consistent weight loss. So this came up because I have a client who I absolutely think is reaching a plateau. So she has lost about 6 kilos to date and she has sat in a similar weight for the last 3 weeks. So since Easter, so how long is that? You know, 8 weeks, say, ago. So she is doing really well and she's very, very consistent with her eating plan. We haven't really changed it significantly since we've started and she's getting 400 grams and now just 200 grams. And she's not unhappy with that, which is probably the most important thing. If the client is happy, she's seeing change, she pulled her jeans on, she was thrilled they're fitting better. But I think this is her body is getting used to the calorie load that she has, it's getting used to her activity levels. And I know to get the next 5 to 7 kilos off, which is to her goal, I'm going to have to mix things up a little bit. So I've just started to plant that in her mind. And I've said, look, I'm happy to let it go while you're happy and it's dropping slightly. But if I'm honest, I'm keen to mix it up and maybe introduce a fasting day. And the purpose of that is to just give that body a metabolic jolt. So it's taking it out of the constant calorie maintenance that she's on and the current activities to just basically give her a metabolic kickstart. So that's one of the strategies I will use when clients are reaching that stage. I might introduce a fasting day. In some clients who are exercising a lot, I may increase calories by about 200 calories per day. In clients who are on reasonably high calories, I might cut it back a couple of hundred. I'll just look at all those variables to see what I can change. Now, what I can share with my specific client is that she eats a very balanced calorie intake of about 1500 calories and she's exercising 3 times a week. Now, I don't really want to cut her calories back dramatically. I don't want her to feel restricted and dieting. She's not at an age or activity level where I need to increase her calories. So my next thing is, can I introduce some fasting just to shake it up a little bit through the week and get her body challenging itself a little bit by restricting calories one day a week. And that's all I'll do in an attempt to get her weight up to about half a kilo a week or 2 to 3 kilos of loss per month for me to make sure we're not plateauing out. And of course, as you would know and specialize in, changing the exercise around is the other variable that we can really use to shift clients off a plateau.
Absolutely. Because yeah, you've got two options when we want to change that. I always think about like weight loss as a scale. You know, we've got, if we're eating more than we're putting out in terms of energy, we're going to gain weight. If we're putting out more energy and eating less, we're going to lose weight. For a plateau, the scale is tipped at the same, isn't it? What we're eating is what we're expending and our weight's staying the same. So we can either eat less from a calorie perspective. It doesn't necessarily mean less food volume, it just means less food and less calories, put it that way. So we still want to focus on higher volume foods. So that's the option I go with for a lot of my clients. I reduce down soul foods. So more of those highly processed foods, we take out the Friday and the Saturday wines, and we have, you know, 3 out of 4 weekends of the month where they're not having any alcohol, because alcohol isn't that filling and it tends to drive up our appetite. So when clients hit up true plateau, I will pull out some of those alcohol and some of those extra soul foods and replace that with a more filling snack, like some veggie sticks and some dip, or a bit of Greek yogurt and some berries, because they feel like they're eating the same amount, but the calorie load is lower. So focus on that volume eating. Or as you mentioned, the other way to tip that scale is to increase energy expenditure. And it's not necessarily that you have to do more sessions in the gym. It's purely just steps. Steps are so underrated for fat loss, particularly for people that have desk jobs. A lot of my ladies go to, you know, really high intensity classes like F45 or HIIT or something like that, some sort of FitStop class 4 or 5 days a week. At the crack of dawn, at, you know, 4:35 in the morning, I'm not a morning person. That's just additional stress to their body. So what I do is actually cut down all of that high intensity training to maybe just 3 sessions a week. And on the other 3-4 mornings of the week, they're going for long, you know, walks that are lower intensity, a lot less stress to their body, but they're just moving a lot more. So that's sort of another way that we can break through that plateau, I guess, as well. Changing up the type of exercise, not necessarily doing more, but just doing it a little bit smarter, I think, as well.
Yeah, I think if we were summarizing what the key to getting off a weight loss plateau is, it's change. It's change something, change everything.
Change something.
For my clients, it's a little bit different. They're often exercising regularly, but not at the right intensity. So their bodies have become really used to what they're doing. So getting a little bit of heart rate monitoring, and sometimes it's less, but better quality. So instead of doing, say, a walk around the park fast, I might say to them, you know, if you did 10 or 20 minutes of intervals on an exercise bike and get your heart rate and keep an eye on it, that's the other variable. So for my older population between, say, 40 and 60, they're moving, but they're not getting their heart rate high enough to get the training effect and to get their muscles more sensitive to insulin and more metabolically efficient over time. So absolutely it's different, but if in doubt, just change something around, because the human body is so smart. It likes to be as stable as possible. And after, like we said, 4 to 6 weeks of eating a similar number of calories and doing the same exercise, if your goal is to lose 10 plus kilos, you're going to have to change something around. So there are a few other variables that you can try to get your fat loss journey back on track.
And that comes down to food as well. The amount of clients, Susie, that I have that are eating the same thing for breakfast, you know, their overnight oats for breakfast every morning, their tuna salad for lunch every day. Dinner is always just like meat and 3 veg. The body doesn't like to do the same things, or actually it very much likes to do the same things, doesn't it? It really enjoys the same things, but for fat loss, it's not ideal. So we want to change up the type of food that we're having, the timing of that. If you wake up and eat breakfast first thing in the morning just because, don't do that. Wait until you're actually hungry. So on the weekends, you might not eat breakfast till 10 o'clock, but during the week, you might wake up and be hungry at 6 a.m. one day and 8 a.m. another day. So really be more in tune with your actual hunger signals, which we've talked about on a previous podcast as well, which again is super important for overcoming that plateau.
And that is one of the reasons that mixing up your daily diet and maybe doing one low calorie day or different on the weekends is very powerful. So change something, change everything. And that is absolutely the key to metabolic fitness over time. So now we're going to move on to one of our favorite segments. It's our product of the week. And this one is a fantastic product for people who love to bake healthier treats and options at home, because Vetta, who already do a range of higher fiber pastas, including some pasta dinosaurs my little boys love, but they've got a new range of flours called the Vetta Smart Protein Flours. There's both a self-raising and a regular variety. And I was really excited to see these in the supermarket a few weeks ago. They've got a 5-star health rating. They've got double the protein and 25% less carbohydrate than regular flour. It's pretty clean ingredient list, as you would expect flour to be. I think the standout thing is that it is quite a lot more expensive. You know, you're looking at about $4.50 for a kilo, which is sort of, I think, about four times what you can get home brand flour for. But I know that we've got a lot of really keen bakers. Whenever we pop up something around protein balls or healthier muffins or healthier banana bread, it goes gangbusters online. So yeah, I think this is a really interesting addition to the flour market, knowing that in the baking section, there's been a huge range of increase in flour. There's now legume flour and coconut flour and a million different types. But this is just a slightly lower carbohydrate, higher protein, higher fiber variety of regular flour, which means it can slip into our baking pretty easily, in my experience. So what did you think when you came across this?
I think it's wonderful. I mean, from a macronutrient perspective, when you're comparing it to just standard, I'm looking at the self-raising Vetta protein flour compared to just the standard self-raising home brand flour. Calorie-wise, pretty much the same. The Vetta is 337 calories per 100 grams. The home brand is 340 calories per 100 grams. So calorie-wise, it's the same. It's the protein where it really stands out. It's more than double. The Vetta one's nearly 22 grams per 100 grams. The standard home brand is about 10.4 grams per 100 grams. The fiber in the Vetta is 9.8 grams per 100 grams, which is huge. And the fiber in the home brand is 3 grams. So as you mentioned, it's really the protein and the fiber that's, you know, more than double, maybe triple that of the home brand or standard variety, which from a fat loss perspective and from a fullness perspective is wonderful. Protein is the macronutrient we know that helps to keep us fuller for longer. And fiber is something that's incredibly important for gut health. So I think absolutely it's a definite win in my books. But I think the thing that a lot of people get caught up in, and I've talked about this on my own podcast, Susie, it's called health halos, where you perceive a product to be healthier, therefore you eat more of it. So it's really important to know that the calorie content of this flour is the same. So if you made 12 brownies with this flour, yes, it would have slightly high protein and slightly high fiber, but you can't eat more of those brownies. If you did, you would gain weight because the calorie content of the flours are the same. That's the most important part. If you just had one of those brownies, you might feel slightly fuller. Maybe long term, your bowels might be slightly better from the higher amount of fiber, but realistically, it's probably not going to do too much unless you're actually changing the recipe overall as well and halving the sugar content, halving the amount of choc chips that you're putting into that brownie, that sort of thing. I think those health halos are things that people really get caught up in, Susie. Yes, this is probably a better type of flour, but calorie-wise, it's the same. And, you know, calories are king for fat loss. Macronutrients matter, absolutely, but calories are king.
Absolutely. I think that's described beautifully. I should have said that the fiber is actually coming from the addition of oat fiber. So it has been increased compared to regular fiber. And I think one of the things with the range of healthier flours out there is they often don't cook as well, because when you start to take the gluten out of flours or put more fat, for example, in the case of coconut flour or banana flour is one I've used, it's significantly different to regular flour. So you get a different texture. It doesn't necessarily bake to the same consistency. It's often a bit heavier. And so it may suit people with dietary intolerances. And the thing with this flour is that it will bake very well because the protein content's high. That's one of the key factors of wheat flour, which makes great banana bread and muffins for people who don't have issues with gluten and are happy to include it in their diet. So I would agree. It's going to give you a technically product that should be slightly more filling. It's going to be healthier for you. But it doesn't mean that you can down 2 slices of homemade banana bread.
I wish.
Because it's using a better flour. And the other thing is it's quite expensive. You know, for people on a budget, if you're trying to cook a bit more with it, I would use it myself because I'm a keen baker and I like to do particularly homemade baked products for my kids. I would use that with their muffins for school, their banana breads. But I am always hastened to recommend things like healthier muffins and banana breads for my own clients because they bake a whole loaf and they eat a whole loaf. And really, it's still, like you said, a reasonably high carbohydrate product. So I tend to agree. I would absolutely use this when I'm doing baking for the kids. But if you're someone who's baking for yourself, you've got to go for minis. So I like the mini loaf tins of the mini muffins. So 2 small minis is a serve, not a big one. And the same with banana bread. You can buy the individual loaf baking trays and that then limits you to that portion. Whereas we've all done it. You make a delicious zucchini, even chocolate banana bread, which she thinks so healthy because it's got dark chocolate and it's got zucchini, and then you slice off pieces all day because it's fresh out of the oven and it's so delicious, and you end up eating 3 or 4 times the amount that's recommended and too much, too dense of carbohydrate and too dense in calories. So I think absolutely if you're a baker for the kids, use it. It's a good product. I think for yourself, don't give yourself permission to overeat. And if you do enjoy some baked products as part of your balanced diet, you've got to get the mini tins, the mini loaves, and balance it out, not just eat it free as we do when we've got a nice warm loaf of anything in our house which smells delicious. So I'm a big fan of baking and giving it away.
And I agree, Susie. And I think, you know, we always talk about a lot, you know, fat loss on this podcast, but I do appreciate there are probably a lot of people listening who actively want to gain weight or who actively are just trying to maintain and, you know, be quote unquote healthy and maintain their healthy diet. So absolutely, baking is something that is wonderful and absolutely okay to do. Just for fat loss, I'm like you, Susie, I really don't encourage my clients to bake at all. And if they're going to go and have a bit of a treat, I'd rather that they go and buy just one muffin or cupcake from their favorite cafe, something delicious and decadent, eat it slowly, mindfully enjoy the heck out of it, then move on, versus trying to bake something a bit healthier in their kitchen. Then they have 12 muffins and they're like, well, what do I do with 12 muffins? They're going to eat them all. That's the problem. So,
because as a reference point, even healthy baked goods, a portion, so a regular muffin or a slice of banana bread is going to clock in at least 250 calories, if not 300. And that's a small meal. So really the portion is half a slice, a mini muffin. So just keep that in mind. And what I'll do is I will pop up a recipe that uses this in it with a nutritional calculation. So you can see that even though it might be slightly higher in protein and fiber, it still needs to be counted as calories, and that'll give you a reference point. So we'll pop that up as well, so you've got, can see how it looks in an actual recipe.
Oh, that's a great idea. And then, Susie, that moves us nicely, talking about fiber, into our listener question of the week, which is all around gut health. So one of our lovely listeners has sent in her question, which is, what are some easy ways I can work on my gut health? And this question excites me because there are so many things that we can do, Susie, when it comes to our gut health. And I think a lot of people automatically think, what pill or powder or probiotic can I take? But when we look at the research overall, what the nutrition research is really telling us in the space of gut health, Susie, and we've known this for the last couple of years, but it is still what we would call new and emerging research, is that the single best thing that we can do for our gut health is eat a diversity of plants in our diet. So that just doesn't mean just veggies. It means veggies, fruits, nuts, seeds. It essentially means fiber. And the more colorful, the better. So what we're really aiming for, the single best thing you can do to work on your gut health, is include 30 different types of plants every single week. Now that sounds a lot, but think about, plants are whole grains, they're nuts, they're seeds, they're fruits, they're veggies, they're salads. If you had a big bowl of banana and chia porridge for breakfast, you know, if you did that every single day, you might get 1 plant point from the rolled oats, 1 point from the chia seeds, 1 point from the banana. You might have 3 plant points. You're aiming for 30 a week. You get 3. If the next day you did flax seeds with raspberries and some quinoa flakes, or rolled oats again, or threw some extra you know, peanut butter in there as well, that could be 4 or 5 different plant points. So it's really about that diversity every single week and not eating the same meal every single day or the same thing for lunch every single day, because it's easy and it quote unquote fits your macros, all that sort of thing. So diversity for gut health is the single best thing that you can do when we look at the research as a whole, essentially.
100%. And it always reminds me that the thing with dietitians is that they eat so much plant-based food. So when you go to a dietitian's conference, and in the old days before COVID, there was a smorgasbord. So there'd be like the hot food, and then there'd be the salad and the vegetables. And at the dietitian's conferences, the salad and the vegetable, there's never anything left. So they eat all of that first and then add it on. And that is probably the main difference between like the meals that I prepare, you prepare, and then when we're looking at client diaries and photographs, we're like, where are the veggies? You know, where are the extra salad and veggies? Because it's that range of options, and including them right through the week as you described, and having 3 or 4 different veggies at dinner, not just one type. And that's where eating out's a problem, because you might have a steak and chips and then they bring a side of broccoli. Whereas if you're at home, you can easily add 3 or 4 different types of veggies. So yeah, I agree 100%. And that's the strong research we have at the moment. I'm with you. I'm not a fan of rushing out and buying expensive supplements when you can do very simple things like adding a serve of fermented dairy into your daily intake, whether it's via a really good quality plain yogurt that has cultures added, or I'm a really big fan of kefir and having that as a supplementary product because that is so rich in probiotic cultures known to nourish the gut from the inside out. And I think the other trick is to really seek out breads and cereals that have some of these great fiber in them. So whether your daily option with carbohydrate is breakfast cereal in the morning or a wrap at lunchtime, or you prefer cracker biscuits or a good quality bread. There's a range of breads and cereals that really are targeted for their digestive health benefits now. And those are proven to contain some prebiotic fibers that really are shown to nourish the gut from the inside out. So I think seeking out a good quality bread or cereal that you include daily is a really important part of that.
Absolutely. And if you asked me, Susie, 10 years ago, when I started working in the hospital system as a more of a new grad dietitian, started working in the gastroenterology clinics, the biggest sort of advice we had was, you know, get in those natural probiotics, the hundreds or billions of good bacteria. What we know now and where the research has really changed is, yes, probiotics are great, but we want them from natural food sources, as you said. What's more important is actually the amount of prebiotics we're getting in. So the probiotics are the good live bacteria. The prebiotics are what are feeding the good live bacteria, because we all have different types of good bacteria in us, and just throwing in billions of live good bacteria may do us more harm than good, because we're upsetting that natural balance we have over time. Probably shouldn't say harm, probably not the right word, but may do us more of a disservice long term by just dumping in billions of live bacteria, versus what we want to do is actually nourish our unique ecosystem that we have in our gut health using natural sources of prebiotics. So some of my favorite ones are things like psyllium husk to add to smoothies and that sort of thing, particularly if you're somebody who struggles to go to the bathroom. You know, there are so many different types of fibers we can get in. There's a lot of even muesli bars and, as you mentioned, breakfast cereals on the markets with some great natural prebiotic fibers as well. So that's really the type of fiber that we really do want to focus on. But just be wary, if you are somebody with IBS or more of an irritable bowel, those prebiotic fibers are generally the types of fibers that will set you off and give you more symptoms. So just go slow and go easy when you're trying to increase the amount of fiber in your diet. You want a ton of water and you want to increase that fiber slowly. If you just start dumping a whole heap of fiber into your diet and your gut's not used to it, you're going to have worse symptoms than what you're going to have worse symptoms. Put it that way. You're going to have a ton of bloating, a lot of gas, quite a lot of pain. So you really do want to go slow and steady with increases in fiber in your diet, even with, you know, natural prebiotic fibers, where might be a wonderful muesli bar on in the shelves of the supermarket, which has 12 grams of fiber. That's wonderful. But if you're not someone that's used to all of that fiber, Susie, you're going to eat that and be super bloated and gassy for the rest of the day, maybe even the next day. So really with those types of products where we've got huge loads of prebiotic fibers, start with a quarter or start with half until your gut adjusts to that over the next couple of weeks.
What bar's got 12 grams of fiber in it?
I think the ones I really used to love were the Freedom Plus, the Bali Plus bars. And they've rebranded, I think, to the Heritage Trail prebiotic ones, where they've taken it down to about 9 grams, okay. I think, these days.
Wow, that's about a third of your daily intake. So that's
used
really significant.
Favorite. I love them. I use them for all my chronic constipation patients.
Oh, that's interesting. That's a really good tip. We'll put a picture of that up as well. My favorite products, the Helga's digestive well-being range of bread, and they've also got a wrap, again very rich in those barley max fibers, which are very good for the gut, and dark rye breads. So the thing about supermarket rye is it actually can be quite a low percentage of rye, whereas the sort of European dark, like pumpernickel, is very very rich, but again you would grade that up very very slowly. And I'm a big fan of good old Ryvita. I think they're great and quite light and a good way to grade up gradually. But we'll pop those products up as well on our socials and our Instagram, the Nutrition Couch podcast, so you can have a look at some of those ones we're talking about.
Wonderful. But I think the biggest thing we can all do for our gut health is a diversity of plants in our diet, really focusing on those fibers and as much variety and as much color as we can get in. That's just general guidelines for health. And that's something that everybody can do, from toddlers right up to great-great-grandparents as well. We can all focus on those sorts of things. And I think it's a wonderful place to start. Susie, what can we add into our diet versus what can we take out of it? Often when we're like, I'm going to work on my gut health, or I'm going to work on losing weight, or I want to be healthy, we focus on all of these things we can eliminate. So I love that our advice for gut health is really on focusing on things we can actually add into our diet, not remove.
100%. Couldn't say it better myself.
And that brings us to the end of the Nutrition Couch for another week, Susie. If listeners, you haven't done so already, please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast to have it delivered straight into your inbox every Sunday morning. And we would absolutely love it if you could leave us a review in the Purple Apple Podcast app. We would be forever grateful for you. The reviews are really what help us rank high on the Apple charts as well. And Susie, our podcast has been at number one since we launched 4 or 5 weeks ago now. So that's absolutely amazing. And thank you guys so much for your support and subscribing as well, because that's what really does affect the nutrition chart. So thank you for helping us put out some great evidence-based information to the public and to you guys. So feel free to ask us any questions, send in your listener questions or case studies on Instagram and Facebook. We're at the Nutrition Couch Podcast, and we will see you guys, or let us hear from you guys next week, Sunday morning when the new podcast episode drops.
Have a good week.